Hello, this is Alton Banks from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. And we begin this week's reading of the Triangle Business Journal on the Biz page. And under the Biz page, we have a few articles. And the first one, under the heading of On the Bus, is Brokers Tour the Triangle and Sing Along as They Do. Standing in front of the mostly complete facades of the perimeter Park 5 and 6 office buildings on October 25th, Trinity Capital Advisors Jeff Sheehan reminded the crowd at the 2018 NAIOP bus tour, a rambunctious group of chattering real estate brokers, just how far the market has come since the depths of the recession. In 2009 and 10, NAIOP, also known as the Commercial Real Estate Brokers Association, didn't host tours because there were few projects to visit. This year's tour began in Glenwood South. From there, brokers spent 9 hours rolling across the triangle on 4 buses, stopping for food and beverages at many high-profile buildings. Brokers were still in high spirits by the last leg of the tour, and one bus, NAI Carolantics, Robin Anders, and CBRE Raleigh's Lee Clyburn even serenaded passengers with Stevie Nicks and Janis Joplin renditions. And under the heading of Big Spotlight comes the article, Raleigh Chef Captures National Attention. Chidi Kumar, born and raised in Chandigarh, India, is the owner of Garland, a restaurant in downtown Raleigh, and her efforts caught the attention of the New York Times on October the 29th. She opened the restaurant in 2013 with her husband, Paul Silver, and has been serving Indian and Pan-Asian food since, with a North Carolina flair. Kumar has an unusual background as is the lead guitarist for the rock band Birds of Avalon. Kumar, after graduating from the University of Massachusetts with a degree in psychology, began studying recipes while on tour with the Cherry Valance. Below Garland's downtown location is cocktail bar Neptune's Parlor, and above it is the music venue King's, both co-owned by Kumar. The Times called her a rock star chef and said her food is nuanced and edgy. And under the heading of Great Booth comes the article, Day of the Dead Livens Up Festival. Raleigh's International Festival celebrates the many regions' different cultures, and Biz had a great time October 27th as one of the judges for the international booths. About 20,000 people attended the festival at the Raleigh Convention Center this year. There was plenty to learn from the dozens of booths. Ukrainians showed off the unique embroidered clothes called Vishivankas. The Scots celebrated poet Robert Burns, and the Koreans explained the unique history of their language. But the most festive booth, and the one the judges awarded the top prize, was for Mexico. There, they celebrated the Day of the Dead, a celebration that culminates November 2nd with fond memories of ancestors. The Mexican booth featured people painted with festive skulls, flowers, candles, and items that recall the deceased person. One Mexican actor, who was known as a heavy drinker, for example, had beer bottles with his photo. So, don't forget to light a candle and remember Biz on November the 2nd, 2068. Also on the Biz page, under the heading of Crowds Coming, is the article, Hamilton is About to Hit Durham, and He'd Love This. If you're lucky enough to have tickets to Hamilton when it opens in Durham, you might want to make your dinner reservations soon. Hamilton was a big hit in Charlotte, with the restaurants and businesses around the Belk Theater. The show ends in Charlotte on November the 4th and opens November the 6th at the Durham Performing Arts Center. Runs through December 2nd. In Charlotte, restaurant owners expect a 25% jump in sales when a popular show arrives. But for Hamilton, sales were up as much as 50%, according to Pierre Bader, the proprietor of the Sonoma Restaurant Group. We've got thousands of people coming to the restaurant, Bader told Charlotte Business Journal. It's like restaurant week times 30. Some Charlotte restaurants opened extra days, brought in more staff, and turned many people away. You can bet the same will happen in Durham. At Bull City Burger and Brewery, one worker noted that at any time Deepak has a show, we batten down the hatches. All this commerce would have pleased Alexander Hamilton himself. Hamilton was a noted capitalist who successfully argued for the founding of the National Bank and remains the face of the $10 bill. And then under the heading of Not As Cheerful comes the article, Holiday Season Can Be a Bit More Pessimistic. Here at Biz, we're not saying the Grinch is about to overtake the economy, but as the holiday season approaches, Triangle entrepreneurs don't find the fourth quarter full of holiday cheer. A survey of local entrepreneurs done by the City of Raleigh and the NC State Entrepreneurship Clinic has again found a dip for Triangle entrepreneurs heading into the fourth quarter. We've been doing it for 4 years now, says Lewis Sheets, an associate professor at NC State University's Poole College of Management and executive director of the NC State Entrepreneurship Clinic. What seems to be happening is that the last two quarters of the year we're going into, let's not say a more pessimistic mode, but a more let's wait and see what happens mode. In the beginning of the year, there seems to be this energy that we're going to conquer the world, and then it peaks, and we come back to reality a bit. For example, in the fourth quarter survey, 81.5% of entrepreneurs expect sales to rise in the next 6 months, a number slightly down from the 83.6% of the third quarter. 53.1% expect capital spending to rise for the next 6 months, compared to 57.2% from the third quarter. And 64.2% expect their employee count to increase in the next 6 months, compared to 64.9% from the third quarter. The survey compiles an overall confidence index that clocked in at 111 for the fourth quarter. That was down from 123 for both the first and second quarters of this year, and the lowest since the 108 of the fourth quarter of 2016. Sheets notes that the Triangle, with an educated population and stable employers, is often insulated from the biggest dips of the national economy. But he says the numbers bear watching as 2019 unfolds. What we do need to watch for is, does it continue to decline or even out in the first and second quarter of next year, he says. If that's the case, there might be a true underlying issue we need to be more aware of and plan for. Next, we turn to the technology and transportation page, and under the heading of development comes the article, Triangle Seeks to Be Home of USDA Research Agencies. The Triangle is making a play to be the headquarters of two federal research agencies, a move that could mean nearly 700 high-paying jobs in the region. The U.S. Department of Agriculture is planning to relocate two bipartisan research units out of Washington, D.C., the National Institute of Food and Agriculture and the Economic Research Service. And officials confirm four entities in North Carolina, including the Research Triangle Region and Chapel Hill, are among those making a pitch for the investment. According to the USDA, the department has received 136 expressions of interest from parties in 35 states, and it's working to narrow the playing field with the help of consultant Ernst & Young. Scott Johnson, Vice President of Agricultural Biotechnology at the North Carolina Biotechnology Center, says he told recruiters North Carolina is an ideal state for the agencies to achieve their objective of immersion within the agricultural community, as it is our leading industry sector. He points to agricultural diversity and short flight times to D.C. as attributes that might attract the federal agencies. And under the heading of Huge Haul comes the article, Epic Games Raises Epic Round of Funding. Epic Games, the carry video game developer behind the acclaimed Fortnite title, has raised nearly $1.3 billion from seven investors. The investment comes from KKR, Iconic Capital, Smash Ventures, Axiomatic, Vulcan Capital, Kleiner Perkins, and Lightspeed Venture Partners. They join existing backers Tencent, Disney, and Endeavor as minority shareholders in Epic, which continues to be controlled by its founder and CEO Tim Sweeney. Sweeney stated the raise reinforces Epic's position of leadership in real-time 3D technology and accelerates our ability to improve the way people play, work, and interact with the world. The company declined to comment outside of its announcement. And under the heading of New Flight Path, the article, Inside Air Canada's Decision to Bring a Montreal Flight to RDU. When Air Canada announced a new nonstop flight from Raleigh-Durham International Airport to Montreal, it was a win for RDU. The Canadian airline confirms that, when it came to the new service, it was a competition between RDU and Charlotte Douglas International Airports. It was a very tough decision, says Lisa Pierce, Senior Director of U.S. Sales and Market Development for the Canadian carrier, noting it came down to exclusivity, as Charlotte already serves the route through American Airlines. Raleigh doesn't have a flight to Montreal, so we wanted to provide a service that doesn't exist today. But Charlotte-Montreal, a very good potential market, could be next on Air Canada's lineup, she hints. Much of the demand in both markets comes down to corporate flying, she says. Pierce declined to note specific companies the airline was partnering with that communicated an interest in an RDU Montreal route, but bolstered by joint venture agreements with airlines, such as United Airlines and Lufthansa Group. There isn't any major corporation in Raleigh and Charlotte that we're not doing business with. And RDU figures show demand is increasing. RDU spokesman Patrick Glace says the airport's latest figures show about 20,000 passengers originating and ending their travel between the cities in 2018, a 21% increase when compared to 2014. Now that RDU has a nonstop to Montreal on the calendar, here are the airport's top five international unserved destinations in terms of passenger demand. And in order from 1 to 5, they are Mexico City, Beijing, Nassau, Rome, and Shanghai. And under the heading of Moving East comes the article, San Francisco Startup Picks Durham for 20 Job Hub. A San Francisco e-commerce startup has picked Durham for an engineering hub, one that a top executive says means 20 hires in the next year. Grove Collaborative, whose platform provides subscription deliveries of all natural home and personal care products, such as Seventh Generation and Burt's Bees, has 95 employees in the Bay Area, says Chris Clark, Chief Technology Officer. But competition for talent there is tight, and retention rates across that region are challenging. So when the company decided to look elsewhere for its next engineering foothold, the Triangle's proximity to universities and technical talent was appealing. We looked at education levels across the area, cost of living indices, and we actually pulled numeric data on software meetups, Clark says. Raleigh-Durham International Airport's nonstop flights to San Francisco were a big deal for us, as was WeWork's plans to expand in the region. They're a good harbinger of technology growth, he adds. In addition to the Triangle, the company had considered Atlanta, Pittsburgh, Denver, and Austin, Texas for the engineering hub, Clark says. And under the heading of Growth Mode comes the article, Raleigh's Filter Easy raises $7 million. Four-year-old downtown Raleigh subscription service Filter Easy just closed on a $6.9 million round, led by Raleigh's own venture firm, One Better Ventures. Filter Easy CEO Thad Tarkington says the money is an opportunity to grow our business, but it's also a chance to bring in the expertise of the OBV team, a group of seasoned investors with a history of brand building. We're big fans of what they've accomplished professionally, he says. OBV, founded by a group of Seventh Generation and Burt's Bees veterans, appears to reciprocate. A securities filing for the fund called OBVFE closed on $5.1 million in equity earlier this year, specifically related to Filter Easy's funder, confirms John Roplickel, former 7th Generation CEO and co-founder of OBV. They're one of the most dynamic growth companies in the Triangle right now, says Roplickel of Filter Easy. It's a great team and a really great product concept in my view. Replicable says it's the disruptive nature that attracted his team. Filters feel like a mundane and sleepy category, he says. most people tend to forget when to replace their filters. They tend to forget the sizes. It's just not a convenient, easy process. And so, through figuring out this great subscription model, they make it totally brainless for a consumer. Now we get to the real estate page of this week's TBJ. And under the heading of public support comes the article, Fenton Project Moves Forward in Cary. The developer behind the long-planned $850 million Fenton mixed-use project in Cary can now buy the land needed for the development and could soon begin constructing the public infrastructure that will support it with backing from the town. That's according to an agreement approved by Cary officials, which ensures the town will reimburse Columbia Development if and when it builds the new roads and underground utilities associated with the development. The sprawling project is viewed as a catalyst for revitalization along Cary's Eastern Gateway Corridor, an area that has had its share of bad news in recent months. In May, IKEA announced it was abandoning plans at the struggling Cary Town Center just across the street. With the agreement in hand, Columbia Development can now move forward with acquiring the 92-acre parcel from the state. The land is located south of the Wake Med Soccer Park and east of Adams Elementary School. Officials from Columbia Development didn't respond to calls for comment, but Deputy Town Manager Russ Overton told Cary officials at a meeting October 25th that development plan approval and site grading could take place over the next year, putting the project on track to begin opening to the public in 2020 and 2021. It would be one of the largest developments in Cary, if not the largest development in Cary that we've ever had, Overton said. Under the terms of the agreement, Cary will pay back Columbia Development up to $22.53 million for work it does to expand existing roads and build new streets. That includes widening Carytown Boulevard and connecting roads within the property. Columbia Development has also agreed to incorporate a number of energy efficiency initiatives into the project, such as electric vehicle charging stations and lighting and mechanical systems that consume less energy. In exchange, the town will pay as much as $5.5 million in development fees for the first two phases of the project. The development agreement represents a significant step forward for the project. News has been sparse since the town approved a zoning change for the project in January, leading to speculation about the project's future. And under the heading of Southeast Focus, Triangle Real Estate Vets look to raise $100 million. Brian Kane and John Pitt formed real estate investment firm SLI Capital a year ago and have already made a splash in the Triangle with major plans to build out the Venable Center property in downtown Durham, along with a group of investors. But that project looks to be just the beginning for the duo, who have backgrounds in raising capital and investing in real estate in North Carolina and beyond. They're trying to raise as much as $100 million to buy and trade properties across the Southeast, according to securities filings. Kane declined to talk about specifics, but said SLI Capital's focus will be primarily in acquiring office and multifamily holdings, rather than operationally intensive investments such as hotels and senior housing. We're focused on the institutionally liquid markets in the Southeast U.S., Kane says. Those include the Triangle, Charlotte, Atlanta, Nashville, Tennessee, and Charleston, South Carolina. Those markets should be familiar territory for Kane, who spent 6 years at FCP, formerly known as Federal Capital Partners, serving as senior vice president and head of the company's Southeast division. And under the heading of New Report comes the article Rents on the Rise for Space and RTP. The downtowns of Raleigh and Durham get much of the attention when it comes to the region's busy office market, but Research Triangle Park has seen its fair share of demand from companies for workspace. That demand is reflected in office rents, which have risen nearly 13% in the RTP and I-40 corridor over the past 2 years, according to CBRE's annual report on tech markets across the country. The increase puts RTP's growth on par with some of the fastest-growing tech markets in the country. The region is ranked 7th for its rent growth rate among the tech markets analyzed for the report. The areas with rising rents are places that are more affordable than traditional tech markets, such as San Francisco, which are seeing tight office markets. As rentable space becomes more difficult to find, CBRE analysts project large tech companies to look for expansion opportunities in smaller markets. For the Triangle in particular, CBRE attributes the growth to the region's innovative environment and low cost of living. Strong employment and education numbers also help. Over the past 2 years, the Triangle's high-tech job base has increased by more than 10%, according to the report. The technology sector remains the most active in our central business district and suburban office markets, CBRE Raleigh Executive Vice President Brad Korsmeyer says. We continue to see major technology companies move to Raleigh-Durham for our qualified workforce and low office rates compared to other major technology markets. And finally, under the heading of Change Coming, the article, Developer Buys Land in Durham Innovation District. The Durham Innovation District's next development could be apartments. Graystar has acquired property along Fernway Avenue. Plans haven't been filed yet, but Graystar has a track record of building apartments in the Triangle, according to the Elon City Center Apartments in Raleigh, which recently sold for a pricey $238,000 per unit. The Durham property is mostly undeveloped. One of the parcels is currently a parking lot and totals more than 8/10 of an acre. Another parcel, located across Liggett Street, is green space and has just 1/5 of an acre. Combined, Graystar acquired the properties for $3.4 million from business entities controlled by James Crawford. The land was previously part of the larger development plans by Blue Devil Ventures, but was sold in foreclosure last year. And under the heading of real estate, on the next page from the Business Journal, and the heading of major draw, Wegmans key to new Wake Forest mixed-use project. The Wegmans plan for Wake Forest is a key ingredient to a much larger mixed-use development that will sprawl across 76 acres on either side of NC 98. That's according to Stiles Senior Development Manager Beth Middleton, whose firm has been working on plans for the project over the past 2 years. The development company has been reviewing the particulars of the site and working with the NC Department of Transportation on approvals for curb cuts providing access to the highway. But the recently announced commitment from Wegmans has allowed the project to move forward, Middleton says. All the retailers and multifamily guys want to be near Wegmans, she says. The development could include all that and more. Middleton says preliminary plans include building a mix of office and retail space, as well as residential development that would likely include condos and townhomes, although apartments are also a consideration. Hotel development is a real possibility, but the details of the plan could change during the rezoning process, she says. Stiles is asking for 460 residential units and 400,000 square feet of mixed-use development, according to a rezoning application. Preliminary plans show hotel and commercial development would take place north of the highway, in addition to some residential development. The Wegmans would be located south of the road, next to another large tract of residential development, with some retail space mixed in. The grocery store would total 100,000 feet. Stiles held a neighborhood meeting recently for people who live near the site, and will take a rezoning proposal before the Town Planning Commission as soon as December, marking the first steps in the longer process of getting the land rezoned and development plans approved. The property belongs to a company controlled by Harvey Forbes, a real estate agent in Sanford, and is mostly treed and undeveloped, with a tax value of $9.8 million. Stiles has only recently entered the Triangle market, with its sole project being the Carolinian residential development on Glenwood Avenue in Raleigh, which it built in partnership with Grub Ventures. But the firm has experience building grocery-anchored retail centers in Charlotte, where the Fort Lauderdale, Florida-based company opened an office in 2012. The Wake Forest location would be the fifth North Carolina store for Wegmans, as it seeks to expand from its home base in New York to markets through the Southeast. The Wegmans on Wake Forest Road in Raleigh is slated to be complete next year and will be the first in the state, while other projects are being planned at the old Performance Auto Mall site in Chapel Hill, the Fenton mixed-use project in Cary, and the new Twin Lakes Center also in Cary. Now we turn to the healthcare and education page of this week's Triangle Business Journal. And under the heading of Next UNC Leader comes the article, Search for New President to Take Time. It might be some time before the University of North Carolina system has a permanent replacement for its next president. Following the announcement of President Margaret Spelling's resignation effective March 1st, the Board of Governors is tasked with finding her replacement, a process becoming familiar in the past decade. In the meantime, the system has hired Dr. William Roper, who's retiring as CEO of UNC Healthcare in May as the interim president. Chairman Harry Smith says he expects the board to take its time finding the permanent replacement. Our focus has been obviously on working to get a great, healthy place and ensure that we did so with nothing but grace, dignity, and respect to the phenomenal job that Spellings has done and the fact we've been so fortunate to have her, he says. We'll move to the next interim process, and then I'll tell you we won't be in a rush. Our focus will be to get it right. According to spokesman Jason Tyson, no process has yet been determined for selecting a permanent president. Tyson did note that the board passed nearly identical resolutions in both 2010 and 2015, outlining a three-committee system to carry out the selection of former President Thomas Ross and Spellings. The former system established three ad hoc committees, the Leadership Statement Committee, which created and forwarded a list of applicants to Section Screening Committee, which forwarded a shorter list to the Search Committee, which largely handled the interviewing and compensation arrangements. The most recent interim president was Junius Gonzalez, who served from January 1, 2015, until Spellings became president on March 1 of that year. Gonzalez was selected following a discussion by the board about whether to choose an internal or external candidate to serve as president. And under the heading of Major Gift comes the article, UNC Alumnus and Cancer Survivor Gifts $10 Million to School. After surviving his own fight with cancer, a Carolina alumnus is giving big bucks back to help advance progress toward the cure. Former Network Solutions CEO WG Champion Champ Mitchell, a two-time graduate of UNC Chapel Hill and survivor of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, has donated $10 million to the Lineberger Comprehensive Cancer Center. The monies, in part donated by his wife Etienne, will be used to create a fund supporting research in blood cancer. The first installment of $1.1 million will be used to advance trials for cellular and other forms of immunotherapy for Hodgkin and non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, acute lymphoblastic leukemias, and multiple myeloma. We were not intimately familiar with cancer research until I got cancer, and UNC was simply great, Champ Mitchell says. The only reason that I am able to sit up and write this check is because of them. Dr. Shelton Earp, director of UNC Lineberger, says the funding is an invaluable asset for taking their research to trial and proving its effectiveness, which will hopefully elicit more funding. And under the heading of Adding Dollars comes the article, Duke Scores $20 Million in Federal Research Grants. Duke University's School of Medicine has received $20 million from three federal grants to benefit its breast cancer and genomic research. The first two came as Duke's Center for Applied Genomics and Precision Medicine was established as the coordinating center for a national initiative to expand genomic medicine's role in clinical practice. Genomic medicine is a discipline that uses DNA and other molecular information to guide treatment and care. The two accompanying grants from the National Human Genome Research Institute total about $9 million. The grants will come in separate tranches over 5 years. Genomic medicine has great potential to improve health, but its widespread implementation has been hampered by the lack of evidence of its clinical utility, says Dr. Jeffrey Ginsberg, director of the Applied Genomics and Precision Medicine Center. These new pragmatic genomic medicine clinical trials will provide that evidence. Ginsberg said the grant funding is unique because it will be used for bringing precision medicine into real-life care instead of being used for research and discovery. I really do believe that some elements of how we use genomic medicine will make healthcare higher quality, more effective, and reduce costs, he said, joking that he has been accused of being overly optimistic. Now we get to this week's cover story, which is entitled Raleigh at Center Stage as IBM and Red Hat Bet Billions on Deal. Red Hat CEO Jim Whitehurst stood in front of hundreds of perplexed faces, telling colleagues, both online and in the folding seat, that the company, long known for its standalone culture, was about to go blue. The day before, on October 28th, employees in Raleigh learned that instead of piling into Red Hat Tower on Monday, their presence would be required at Duke Performing Arts Center downtown for an all-hands meeting to talk about the surprise news most of them hadn't seen coming. Red Hat, the millennial-savvy jeans-wearing brand that had just celebrated its culture with Red Hat Agile Day 2018, was being bought by corporate stalwart IBM. "You're probably in some stage of absolute shock, fear, scared, and I get that," Whitehurst said. "And there are a lot of emotions associated with this, certainly for me, and I know many, many, many of you." Some of the crowd, flecked by the customary red hats and the hatters, received after their hire, nodded in response. "Think about what we continue to talk about at every company meeting, which is, we have just such a massive, massive, massive opportunity in front of us," Whitehurst opined, "and we see that every day." His biggest frustration, he told the crowd, "We don't have the resources. We don't have the commercial breadth. We don't have the depth." Enter IBM, a 380,000-employee behemoth that solves all those problems for us, he said. But the $34 billion price tag comes with a risk of its own. The culture Whitehurst and others before him built is on the line. Whitehurst, for his part, said it's in safe hands, pointing to IBM's pledge to keep this brand as a standalone operation. Red Hat, even as it built a reputation as a disruptor, was also crafting a cultural brand, one outlined in Whitehurst's own book, The Open Organization. Red Hat is an experiment in applying the principles of open source for how you run an organization that engages participative communities inside and out, Whitehurst wrote in 2015. IBM, once known for a conservative approach marked by its suits and white shirts, has worked hard over the years to shift its own brand toward the collaborative, opening up agile workspaces at its massive RTP campus as it transitions toward emerging technologies such as cloud and cybersecurity. But the opaque white walls that framed its development teams haven't entirely come down. While Red Hat is an urban company where jeans are encouraged and walks to downtown Raleigh sandwich shops are routine, IBM remains on its expansive campus at the largely unchanged RTP. IBM has seen multiple layoff rounds and is defending itself against federal lawsuits accusing it of age discrimination. And while Red Hat's earnings calls talks about growth expectations, IBM's calls continue to talk up traction in an ongoing transition. IBM, for its part, has said the Red Hat brand and management team will remain untouched for cultural and business reasons. To remain neutral, a Switzerland in the software landscape, executives say it's important that Red Hat remain a separate entity. While nearly a year to go before deal closure, the companies will need to sell that message to employees, analysts say. As it's an open source company, the real value is in its people and their expertise, and that's set to diminish if Red Hatters jump ship, Mushian says. Diane Adams, Chief Culture and Talent Officer at Sprinklr, agrees. Adams, whose tenure includes executive positions at Cisco and Allscripts, says Red Hat's culture is effective because the company has engaged its staff to rally around the mission. The key to keeping the culture will be in keeping that mission, she says. In her tenure at Cisco, she saw more than 100 acquisitions, and the ones that worked there were where they were allowed to continue to thrive relative to their culture, Adams says. In Red Hat's case, Whitehurst's commitment to stay on as part of IBM's executive team, reporting directly to IBM CEO Gina Rometty, works in his favor, as he'll likely be a strong advocate for the culture he helped build, Adams says. And keeping employees through the close of the deal requires something Red Hat is already good at, she adds. Communication. They're going to have to acknowledge the uncertainty, talk about how they're going to keep the culture, and have open, two-way communication, she says. While IBM has conducted several acquisitions, analyst Mushian says this is IBM's first go at bringing in a company and saying right from the get-go this is going to be operated as a standalone unit. and IBM needs to execute the deal perfectly, she says. Otherwise, the price tag, which already means debt for IBM, will sink Big Blue even further, she adds. And IBM has banked its strategy, not just its billions, on the deal. It's a way for IBM to get access to the mid-market, Mushin says. It's something they're not necessarily great at executing, whereas Red Hat is very pervasive there. And if they have access to IBM's global scale and IBM's global enterprise base, that could really help scale Red Hat's own portfolio reach. But even with the business case for the deal, overlap exists that can make its way into Red Hat Tower. The deal brings Red Hat under IBM's Technology Services and Cloud Platform Group, which has a ton of services people of its own, some of which are trained in Red Hat, she says. Are they going to keep Red Hat people and do more layoffs at IBM, or vice versa? Mushin predicts IBM is the only suitor able to offer Red Hat a buyout at that price, particularly as Microsoft recently made its own major open source move in acquiring GitHub. Mushin says there could be an ulterior motive behind the acquisition, noting that Rometty could be near retirement. IBM tends to hold on to their CEOs until they turn 60, and Ginni Rometty is now 61, she says. Could they be trying to prime Red Hat's CEO to take over IBM? Even if that's the case, Mushin says she can't begin to predict what that might mean for the triangle, where Whitehurst and his wife, entrepreneur Lauren, have built their home and family. The deal makes IBM's presence in the region even more massive. Already, IBM owns more than 900 acres and 3.2 million square feet of office space in RTP, a campus that has anchored the sprawling office park since the 1960s. And it has a small office footprint at Centennial Campus. Red Hat occupies its entire building in downtown Raleigh with subleases running through 2035. And through its 2015 Ansible acquisition, it also leases space above the Durham Bulls Athletic Park. It's a combined footprint that far exceeds the 450-acre IBM World Headquarters in Armonk, New York. When asked if IBM and Red Hat might utilize each other's real estate, Steve Robinson, IBM's RTP-based general manager of cloud platform services, said, "We're not even close to being able to speculate on that." On a media call, however, Arvind Krishna, senior vice president of hybrid cloud and director for IBM Research, opened the door to that possibility, joking that he might someday move offices into Red Hat's Boston location. "It's literally nicer than where I am right now," he said. It's a statement that unknowingly sums up some of the Red Hatters' fears, expressed online in the days following the deal announcement, even as executives continued to try to quell concerns through a series of conference calls, memos, and that all-hands meeting in Raleigh. On Reddit, anonymous users opined about what they feared would be the death of Red Hat. They swapped stories about colleagues already purportedly leaving for competitors, such as Google. But executives insist the fears are unsubstantiated. "Red Hat as a brand is going to keep going for as long as I can foresee. There's no time limit on that," Krishna told reporters. "They're spending $34 billion on an open-source technology company," added Paul Cormier, executive vice president at Red Hat. "That means they're not buying IP, they're not buying technology, they're buying people. I think that's a testament in the level of investments to help maintain the culture that's made Red Hat the value it is today." Still, industry watchers say that no matter what, something bigger is changing, bigger than a stock ticker. They get a really great premium, but at the same time, the Triangle loses another headquarters, says Joe Colipi, a Red Hat alum who went on to found Bronto Software. "Even though Red Hat will be run independently, it's not the same, and over time, things will change. It might take a while, it might be slow, but they will change." It's definitely the end of an era, agrees Todd Olson, whose growing downtown Raleigh tech firm, Pendo, is one of several companies in line to be the next homegrown brand. It's kind of sad. But both see opportunities rising from whatever's left, however, no matter what happens in the coming decades. For Olson, it can mean recruitment opportunities as his firm, now at 150 employees, continues to compete for talent. Red Hat culture is probably very different from IBM culture, and while it will take a while for the dust to settle, you'll start seeing an opportunity to recruit from there, he says. Colipi sees new companies emerging, should seasoned executives embark on their own. Now we need to build the next Red Hat, right? So 20 years from now, we can have another $1 billion exit, he says. And Young says the $190 per Red Hat share IBM is paying will create major liquidity. He uses himself as an example. When he sold off shares in the company years ago, he invested the money into new ventures, such as Raleigh's drone developer Precision Hawk and his own publishing startup Lulu. Think of all the investment money now freed up, Young says. A whole bunch of investors now have capital to invest in the next big thing. They've just empowered a huge investment in the open source community. Now we turn to this week's executive voice. And this week's executive voice belongs to Jim Carrier. In August of 2016, four of North Carolina's largest orthopedic practices came together to form what's now known as Emerge Ortho. Its reach extends to 49 locations in 21 North Carolina counties, from the mountains to the coast. The practice offers orthopedic surgery, rehabilitation services, rheumatology, neurology, and vein therapy, among other services. The group employs a total of 1,600 people. It has 750 employees, including 61 practicing physicians, across 23 locations in the Triangle area alone. Leading this charge is the company's CEO and Triangle leader, Jim Carter. He's a nearly 30-year veteran of the healthcare space and was named to this post in July of last year. Triangle Business Journal caught up with Carrier to get his take on the current healthcare climate and learn more about how he plans to expand Emerge Ortho in the Triangle and beyond. So here's the Q&A. What led you to your current post? I previously served as CEO of Carolina Orthopedic Specialists based in Hickory for 7 years. COS merged with three other groups in 2016 to form Emerge Ortho PA. I transitioned to the CEO of the Triangle region when the previous CEO retired in 2017. So what's your opinion on the overall state of healthcare in the U.S.? Healthcare costs are rising faster than the GDP, which is unsustainable going forward. Our practice has been at the forefront of alternate payment models for over 7 years now. Soon, third-party payers will change the old model of do more, get paid more. Through these programs, we've substantially lowered costs for large orthopedic surgeries through better management of care. Emerge Ortho and Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina released data back in 2014 that conservatively showed that a 20% savings for total knee replacements. So what are major differences, good and bad, in operating independently as a physician practice versus operating under a healthcare system umbrella? Emerge Ortho is proud of the fact that we remain independent, and we believe this allows us to keep costs down substantially. As a result, we are more flexible with a quickly changing healthcare environment. Our practice offers many of the same services that a large health system offers, such as surgery centers, MRI, CT, and multiple service lines. We also feel that there is a unique ability to offer coordinated lower cost of care in partnership large healthcare or academic centers across the state. And our geographic footprint locally and across the state offers unique advantages in this regard. So what can you do to mitigate physician burnout? Our group recognizes that this happens to physicians that are in the field for 20 plus years. We previously offered a sabbatical policy that we've discussed bringing back. In addition, we offer extensive PTO and CME benefits. So what have you pursued in the areas of telemedicine and virtual health care? We've just begun with telemedicine. There are still development issues to work out with respect to how our insurance payers require the visits to be documented and billed. However, telemedicine is an initiative that offers tremendous patient convenience as well as the ability to network with other healthcare professionals. Emerge Ortho fully embraces this technology and has plans to incorporate this into our practice statewide. So what are your goals for Emerge Ortho? Short term, expansion into the Triad market in the middle of North Carolina is an immediate goal for Emerge Ortho. Long term, continue some same store growth in the markets that we serve, improving cost clarity for all patients, and expansion of cost-saving models for patients and payers alike. Currently, we are refining tools to provide patients more transparency with respect to pricing and overall cost of care, and health care costs will begin to be contained when the patient is empowered to navigate quality care related to costs. So what's the greatest piece of advice you've ever been given, and who gave it? Be myself, and always treat others fairly and with respect. This from my dad. What books are currently on your nightstand? The Bible, The Deep State by Jason Chaffetz, and Alignment 2.0 by Bill Champion. Next, we turn to the small business page of this week's TBJ, and the article is entitled, Blockchain Could Play a Role in Protecting U.S. Votes. You can tell it's November again because half the country is yelling at the other half. Let's examine how technology is changing our elections. As technology permeates our lives, hacking has become our fastest-growing crime. Centralized IT systems attract hackers because all the loot is stored in a central location with millions of access points. Hackers just have to find one weak point to score big. No one would build a bank vault with a million doors, but that's how we move and store data. Blockchain is the technology counterpoint to centralized IT systems, but before we look at current blockchain voting systems, let's examine America's long history of election cheating. Russians have grabbed election tampering headlines lately, but foreigners looking to influence American elections is nothing new. Technology, such as Google, Facebook, and Twitter, facilitates foreign influence over American elections because it's easier to influence debate on these technology platforms than the thousands of local newspapers, town meetings, and dinner discussions those technology platforms have replaced. But hacking to change election results is different from trying to influence how Americans vote. Changing actual election results is an all-American sport, foreigners not allowed. The old way of tampering involved stuffing the ballot box. We think of this in the context of paper ballots, but before people could read and write, ballots were sometimes cast using different colored stone or other symbols, hence the term blackballing. Paper ballots were a technology improvement over stones. Digital voting opens the process to long-distance stuffing. Say what you will about our sordid history of election tampering. At least it was a local process. A cynic might say that Americans traditionally were less concerned with election cheating than with keeping cheating local. Our Constitution enshrines the fear of long-distance cheating by allocating representation by House districts and not using popular votes to elect presidents. Senators were elected by state legislatures, not statewide elections, until about 2 years ago. Because of technology, we're losing the option to deal only with local political rascals. Blockchain is the next logical election technology because it decentralizes data and easily identifies when data has been changed. Broadridge, which counts votes for public company shareholder meetings, tested a blockchain voting system in March. American and international stock exchanges have been experimenting with blockchain stockholder voting to replace inefficient proxy systems. We don't know how blockchain voting will change our elections, but it's fun to speculate. Let's examine the age-old practice of paying people to vote. Voting early and often was lucrative. Blockchain may make it easier to sell your vote. Instead of politicians paying millions for TV advertising, they could just pay voters cryptocurrency. Why should TV stations be the only ones to get rich every November? This reminds us that when we fix one problem with technology, we often create other problems. Now, as we approach the back of this week's TBJ, we get to the Viewpoint page. And the guest article this week is written by John Hood, who's the chairman of the John Locke Foundation in Raleigh. And under the heading of Election 2018, his article is entitled, Not Many Voters Split Their Tickets. As politics become polarized, even if you and I agree on little else, I'll bet we agree that the answer is clearly yes. But as the wild and wacky elections of 2018 near their close, it's worth considering what political polarization is and what it is not. Not that long ago, a significant share of voters split their tickets between two major parties. They voted for Republican candidates for president and other federal offices, for example, even as they were perfectly willing to elect Democrats to state and local offices. That was a familiar pattern in southern states. Elsewhere in electorates such as the Northeast Corridor and some western states, ticket splitters often went the other way, Democratic for federal office, Republican down the ballot. Here in North Carolina, as many as a quarter of voters used to be fairly reliable ticket splitters. Indeed, as recently as 2004, Republican President George W. Bush won 56% of the North Carolina vote for re-election, at the same time that Democratic Governor Mike Easley won 56% of the vote for his re-election bid. The electorate is much more polarized now. Does anyone truly believe that, say, in 2020, Roy Cooper could win re-election with 56% of the vote, while Donald Trump won 56% of North Carolinians' votes for president? Both won in 2016, of course, but their margins were either close, 4 points for Trump, or raisin thin, 0.2% for Cooper. The share of voters truly up for grabs is probably in the single digits now in our state, and not much higher in most other states. Although a healthy ticket-splitting contingent still exists in states such as Massachusetts and Maryland that are generally blue but seem poised to re-elect their popular Republican governors by large margins. The primary explanation, according to most analysts, is that the parties have become more ideologically standardized. Historical patterns of conservative Democrats in places like North Carolina and liberal Republicans in places like Connecticut have run their course. The two major parties have sorted themselves ideologically. Voters have followed suit. The rise of the unaffiliated voter is not a challenge to this explanation, by the way. Joining a party and voting consistently for a party are not the same thing. Nearly one-third of North Carolina voters have no partisan registration. There are more unaffiliated voters than there are registered Republicans. Still, the vast majority of these unaffiliated North Carolinians vote reliably red or reliably blue. They may not be joiners, but they have strong partisan preferences. I've made this observation many times, and I stand by it. However, there is an ambiguity that sometimes causes confusion. To say that most voters have sorted themselves by party is not to say that there's only one kind of Republican or one kind of Democrat. The two major political parties remain broad coalitions, not the political equivalent of religious denominations. Different analysts use different taxonomies to describe them. One long-time system, based on surveys by Gallup and other pollsters, identifies two different Republican-leaning groups, conservatives and libertarians, along with progressives and populists as Democratic groups, plus a shrinking but still significant centrist group in the middle. Other taxonomies are more complicated. A new study called Hidden Tribes, published by the organization More in Common, has been making headlines recently. It identifies seven groups on a left-to-right scale: progressive activists, traditional liberals, passive liberals, politically disengaged, moderates, traditional conservatives, and devoted conservatives. Setting aside the pros and cons of each approach, the valuable part of such exercises is that they distinguish between partisan polarization and viewpoint polarization. Reliably Republican voters disagree among themselves on a variety of issues, so do voters in the Democratic coalition. These disagreements can be passionate, but switching one partisan allegiance in response to such disagreements has become surprisingly rare. That's polarization for you. It explains a lot about today's politics. Whether the phenomenon will persist into the future is anyone's guess. And finally this week, from the editor's notebook, comes the article, Raleigh on the Losing Side of IBM Red Hat Monster Deal. Make no mistake, Raleigh will be on the losing side of the $34 billion IBM Red Hat deal. In the past few days, I've seen a few business groups around the Triangle spin their way into opining that the buyout of arguably Raleigh's most prominent company to the world will actually emerge and will actually energize the tech sector and add to the vibrancy of our startup ecosystem. Not only that, some argue, since a merged IBM and Red Hat will be stronger, we may have expansion firms from both entities, therefore accelerating the creation of new jobs in Raleigh and RTP. To really understand the after effects of a big merger, we looked at a few local deals across different industries in the past few years. Our deep dive on the IBM Red Hat deal in the paper this week indicates a graphic to that effect. Just looking at that graphic, one can extrapolate that when a local company hands off the ultimate decision-making power to the out-of-town entity, not much good is in store in terms of the identity of the selling company, be it physical presence, back office jobs, or executive privileges. One of the most recent deals that comes to mind is when Connecticut-based IMS brought Durham's Quintiles for about $9 billion 2 years ago. Quintiles, the world's largest clinical research organization at that time with some 28,000 people worldwide and more than 2,500 people locally, was a big player in the local market. Senior leaders were asked to sit on Triangle job recruiting pitches. Company executives volunteered their time to sit on nonprofit boards, and employees joined community efforts that made all of us better citizens. After merging, IMS changed the company's name to ICVIA. Would anyone deny that ICVIA's contribution to the Triangle today is only a fraction of what Quintiles did for more than 30-odd years? This pattern of a selling company becoming less influential in their communities is not an aberration. It's normal across the country and the world. True, there will be some winners from the IBM Red Hat deal, starting with the executives, who own sizable shares. Perhaps some of them will start investing in local ventures with their windfall, while others might leave IBM Red Hat to start their own ventures. But Red Hat CEO Jim Whitehurst was called on to support several community initiatives in the past decade, most of which he was happy to oblige, because he knew bringing influential companies to the area would help the cause of the community he calls home. For now, Whitehurst is not going anywhere, so I assume he will continue to do that. But for how long? However, there's one sliver of hope. Perhaps Whitehurst and his hybrid cloud team will perform so well that IBM's Red Hat unit surpasses all operating expectations with a massive return on investment. Well, that music means we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. We hope you've enjoyed it. Be certain to listen next time. I'm Alton Banks, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. So long till next time. If you have comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138.